lawsuit is settled. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Opening statements begin today in Orlando in Casey Anthony's high-profile murder trial. She's the Florida mother accused of killing her young daughter nearly 3 years ago. The emotionally charged trial and heavy media attention prompted attorneys to hold jury selection outside of Orlando. The jurors are expected to be sequestered for up to 2 months. If convicted, Anthony may face the death penalty. Flights out of northern England, northern Ireland, and Scotland are expected to be affected today because of an ash cloud from an Icelandic volcano. British authorities say airports will remain open. They're advising passengers to check with their airlines before traveling. A similar volcanic eruption about a year ago severely disrupted travel across Europe, stranding millions of travelers. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at kauffman.org.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The government of Syria is facing the greatest challenge to its authority in 40 years. It has been estimated that since mid-March, as many as 900 people have been killed in political protests, many more injured, 10,000 arrested. In this part of the show, we'll try to get a better understanding of what's going on in Syria and how it is connected to the kinds of protests that we've seen elsewhere in the Middle East and in North Africa over the past couple of months. And our guest for the program is Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies and associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma. He teaches modern Middle Eastern history and politics. He writes on Syria and its surrounding countries. He writes Syria Comment, which is a daily newsletter on Syrian politics. He also is called on often to comment on Syria on television and radio, and we're pleased that he could give us some of his time this morning. As we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. All people need to do is call us. We hope that people will be on target with their comments and can be brief so that we can make room for as many different callers as possible. But people are certainly welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And we do also have email. So if you'd like to send us a question that way, you certainly may. And that is WILL-talk, will-talk at illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. And Professor Landis, hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And you?
It's great to be here.
Good. Well, we certainly appreciate you spending some time with us. We have seen now over the past few months this wave of political protests and activity sweeping across North Africa and the Middle East, beginning in Tunisia, then spreading to Egypt and elsewhere. So on one level, one has to acknowledge that what we've now seen in Syria is part of this, but also I'm sure there are some things that make the Syrian experience unique. So maybe we could deal with this as two separate sort of questions. And I would say first, in what way is what we've seen in Syria connected with Egypt, Tunisia, and elsewhere?
Well, it's very similar in some ways. It's inspired, of course, as you say, by this Arab Spring. But in other ways, it's very different because Syria, like Lebanon and Iraq, is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious society. And that makes revolution extremely difficult. And it also means that the country could face, you know, sort of internal divisions and possible civil war, unlike Tunisia and Egypt, which are all Sunni, all Arab. Now, of course, in Egypt, there's a small Coptic Christian population, but they didn't have political power. In Syria, very different. The Alawites, a minority, about 12% of the country, a Shiite offshoot sect, have the reins of power in their hand. The president is an Alawite. His brother heads the Republican Guard, which is 10,000 strong, all Alawite troops that protect the presidency. And so in order to overthrow this regime, it becomes much more difficult. In Egypt, the army turned its back on the president. The same thing happened in Tunisia. The president was forced to resign. That's not going to happen in Syria, and it hasn't happened. The army has remained loyal to the president and has been willing to suppress and shoot on the people, suppress this uprising. So the revolutionary movement that has spread through Syria faces much more difficult and a much more protracted struggle ahead.
Well, now, let me then maybe take a step back and ask a little bit larger question. Given that the circumstances in Tunisia and Egypt were really different than elsewhere in this respect, that is, the military turned on the rulers, and that's what made the change in government possible. And I don't think that's happened any place else. Does that really mean that what happened in Tunisia and Egypt were anomalies, and that we maybe should not expect to see that kind of dramatic change very many other places?
Yes, I think that's true. Most regimes in the Middle East have been plagued with coup d'etats. In Syria, that was the case for 20 years after independence. The French ruled Syria in the interwar period up to 1946. They left, and when they left, there was a series of coups from 46 right up to 1970, when Hafez al-Assad, the father of Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, took power and figured out how to put an end to the terrible stability that had beset Syria. There were perhaps 20 successful and failed coups over the previous 20 years. Syria was sort of the banana republic of the Middle East. And the way he brought stability was to harness traditional loyalties. That meant using his family and the clan structure, using his village tribal structure within the Alawite community, and using the Alawite community writ large, that sectarian community. Plus, he made very important strategic alliances with other major groups. Now, the Sunni Muslims are the majority in Syria. Sunni Arabs are about 65% of the country. And they had always ruled under the Ottoman Empire, under the French. They had been the most influential. They were the rich people from the cities, the urban, the elite, the educated. And he needed them to stand by his side in order to rule effectively. And the way Hafez al-Assad did that was to bring them in as to make money. The merchants, using patronage, using graft, using corruption, he brought them in as partners of the regime so that their loyalty would be glued to this regime. And that's the situation today. And that's why the two major cities in Syria, Damascus, Aleppo, constituting about half the population, have not seen major demonstrations in the urban centers. There have been demonstrations on the outskirts where people are poor, but not. This is not like Cairo, Tunisia, where the central square in the capital city gathered hundreds of thousands of people that overwhelmed state security and offices. Very different situation.
Just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at University of Oklahoma, where he is associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies. He teaches modern Middle Eastern history and politics, particularly is interested in Syria, and writes a lot about Syria and also its neighbors. And we're talking about recent political upheaval in Syria. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I think it might be interesting just to explore a little bit of the history of the country in the sense that the current president, Bashar al-Assad, has been ruling since his father died, and his dad, Hafez al-Assad, ruled the country for something like 30 years. And as you mentioned, that they're both members of this minority sect, the Alawites. They are Shiite. The majority of the country, the majority of Syrians, are Sunnis. How is it that you actually came to this point where you have this minority ruling the country?
That's a very good question, and it's really due to the French. These are Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Palestine too. The colonial powers set up minorities to rule, believing that they would be more friendly and would help cement their presence in the region, which they did. And in Lebanon, the Maronite Christians were empowered, their presidency, chief of staff of the army, so forth, Maronite. Syria, the Sunnis were established in positions of power because they were by far the most, you couldn't avoid them. But what the French did, because there was a big nationalist uprising against the French occupation after First World War, the French had to draft a local army. They couldn't do it themselves. It was too expensive, especially after the French were completely ruined after the First World War. So they drafted local people. And who would shoot on the Arab nationalists in the cities? Why, poor country people and minorities. And this is why the Syrian army got stacked with minorities, in particular Alawites, who later found their way to the top of the pyramid and took power for themselves. And so they were recruited very heavily, and they had been a sort of despised population, very segregated, very poor, not considered Muslims by the majority Muslim population because they were considered extremists, if you will, sort of like Mormon Christians, I suppose, in an American context. Now, today, of course, in America, most liberal Americans consider the Mormons Christians because they believe in Jesus Christ and in the Bible. But others, fundamentalists, say no, they're not Christian because they add prophets and they add a book. And that's, you know, forbidden. Now, that's the same thing that the Alawites do in a sense. And Muslims are much less forgiving of that sort of, you know, tinkering with the books and the prophets. So it's much more difficult for them to become integrated in society, and they took power, and that's resented by the Sunni majority. They have ruled Syria as a secular nation and have tried to downplay religion as much as they could, but they have been a sectarian regime. They've, you know, set up the top of the military, the top of the security forces are all Alawites who are connected in. Most of them are Alawites, not all. Down below, it's Sunnis and everybody else. But and in the politics, the parliament and so forth, it's been very Sunni-dominated, and the Sunnis are given the lion's share of the economy and so forth. But in the security forces, Alawites have the main power. And that's how they've coup-proofed Syria and kept stability, and that's why it's going to be such a difficult struggle to push them aside.
Yeah. Well, that gets to the, and I have a caller here, I promise I'll get to this person, but that gets to an important question here, in as much as there are people within Syria that support the regime, they support Bashar al-Assad, and that would be the military and the security apparatus, and also the business community right. That's interested in having stability so they can continue to do business.
And the Christian community. There's about 6 to 10% of Syria are Christians, and they, as a minority, who fear Islamic fundamentalists taking over, cling to the regime in many ways. And so there are other minorities that are also very pro-regime. So Syria, it's not just the small evil people at the top ruling over these giant democratic ocean. That's the way it's often depicted, but it's much more complicated than that.
So who is it then in Syria that would really like to see Bashar al-Assad go?
Well, let me just give you a little economics here. 48% of Syrians, last census, are 19 years old and younger. Extremely young country. Giant youth bulge. Too much population growth. 32% of Syrians live on $2 a day or less in poverty, according to the UN as it's defined. But, I mean, half of Syria is really poor. And they spend about 50% of their daily income on food alone. And those food prices have been screaming up all over the world. The average basket of food for Syrians has increased by 20% just this year. And wheat, for example, has gone up by 100% in the last 2 years. And that is, you know, that's the staple food for poor Syrians. They eat bread. And so Syrians, there's not enough, there's terrible joblessness, there's not enough growth, even though the growth has been at 5% as it was in Egypt or Tunisia, that's not enough. These poor countries that have this big population growth and are suffering from commodity price hikes need growth on the order of 8-9%, like China, like Turkey, like Brazil, in order to break out of this poverty and sop up unemployment. And they're not getting it. The governments have failed to bring that kind of growth.
We have a caller here. We'll get to them right now, and we'll get to others. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Belgium is the caller here, line number four. Hello.
Hello, and I'm going to have to complicate your situation a little bit because a recent thing has happened in my life in that my youngest son went to Syria for a vacation, and he just got back about, 3 weeks ago maybe, a little bit more than that. And when he told me he was going to go, I was very frightened because of the events in Syria. But then after he went and he came back, he portrayed a totally different picture of Syria than what I hear on the news. It was very pleasant. People were very, very accommodating. He had a great time, enjoyed Syria immensely. But yet we hear of all this violence. He saw no violence whatsoever. Now, admittedly, they did keep him out of some cities, which probably where the violence is at. But it seems like there's two different pictures that are being presented here to me, and I'm not sure where to go from.
Well, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, it depends on where you. It really depends on where you go, doesn't it?
It does, and your caller is absolutely right. This is something that lots of people remark on. Syria is a big country, 22 million people. It's about the size of France. The big cities have had very few demonstrations, and those they've had are in the sort of poorer outskirts, so that a tourist would never see them. You know, this would be like living in America when you have sort of riots in the cities in 1968 or something like that. You would never know it if you're the average American unless you're watching TV. So, you know, there have been 1,000 people killed in Syria, we believe, roughly about 1,000, in the last 2 months. Now, if you're a tourist, you're going to go through and see lots of, you know, see life as normal in Damascus or Aleppo and most places. And you're not going to notice this. And the Syrian TV is trying to show a different picture. And on TV at night, I get Syrian TV here in the States, and you can watch it. And they'll show, you know, life is normal, interviews with artists, life going along, just peachy. You turn to Al Jazeera, and they are cycling through these videos that are snuck out of the country, the telephone videos, that are, and they loop them so that there's constant sort of live coverage of the same demonstration over and over again. And it looks very much like there's, you know, Syria is in this state of heightened revolution. Now, that revolutionary fervor, though, is underneath it all, and a tourist won't notice how nervous the people are. But people living there, you know, are very anxious about their future. The economy is shot. Things are not looking good in terms of, you know, sort of regaining stability. The West has completely sanctioned Syria. Both Europe just announced new sanctions. So has the United States. Sanctioned the leadership. They haven't sanctioned all trade. America has sanctions on trade, but not Europe. But still, the economy is hitting a very rough patch.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. The protest began in the city of Daraa, which is way down in the southern part of the country near the border with Jordan. And there were other apparently significant protests in the third largest city in the country, a city of Homs. Is there something about those places that would make it likely that protests would occur there and not in the big cities like Damascus and Aleppo?
Well, there's a number of reasons. Most prevalent, perhaps, is that the provincial cities, the smaller provincial cities, have been ignored by this regime. Aleppo, Damascus have been spoiled. That's the big commercial centers. There's where most of the businessmen are, most of the money coming down, and attempts by Bashar al-Assad to globalize Syria, liberalize the economy, move from a socialist economy to a capitalist economy, which he has been trying to maneuver the country through, introducing private banks, stock market, etc., has helped the very, very top of society who are getting international salaries today. But the bottom half of society has had the wind taken out of it because it's lost socialist supports. Inflation has opened, the country's been open to inflation. A flood of new foreign goods have come in that are very expensive and that people want but they can't get their hands on. So the income gap has widened, and we've seen that here in most countries in the world, in the United States as well, but in Syria, it's much more visible, and the poor are much poorer. So it's created a lot of class tensions. But then there are sectarian tensions. And in Daraa, in the south, very Muslim country, agricultural. Now, Syria has also gone through a terrible drought in the last 4 years, which have hammered agricultural districts like Daraa. And then Homs, there's been the most prevalent, as you say, demonstrations have been Homs, and in the coastal cities, Latakia, Banias, and Jebele down the coast. These are cities like Homs where Alawites and Sunnis live cheek by jowl, where they share the same urban space. And there is a sectarian element to this uprising. And that those cities have seen the worst violence.
To another caller here, somebody in Piatone, line one. Hello.
I think this whole world's in turmoil when it comes to what you're talking about economy-wise. Economics of the world is kind of turned upside down its head, and it's hurting people like Syrians and other countries. But one thing we got to do is we got to start focusing on ourselves. Our problems are, to me, much worse than the Syrian people, only in the fact that if we go down, then who else is going to go over there and take care of them? And it's a sad fact, but it's true. We seem to meddle in everybody's affairs, and we seem to be the only ones that can handle some of this stuff. So if we go down, then what happens to the rest of the world? That's a bigger issue than that. I have friends that have gone over, just like the gentleman that was on before, and said the same thing, that you can go over there and walk around. And if you're born and raised out there, you know where to go and what not to go. But there has to be some stability before anything can go any further. I hope and I pray that these people, the whole world, comes together here soon. Something's got to be done because we're sinking really quick for everybody. And it's just going to open a can of worms for a lot more countries. We haven't seen the bottom, I don't think, yet. Thank you.
Well, I think your caller brings up an important point, which is that this is not particular to the Middle East. The Middle East, in a sense, has caught a particular virus because they share a common culture. And when Tunisia went, the same problems. Now, there's these deep economic problems, but there's also a cultural problem in the Middle East, a problem of governance, which is dictatorial regimes, which have spread from one end of the Arab world to the other, have been ruling since decolonization in the 1940s and 50s. And the people are beginning to demand a change, and that has spread within the Arab world in this particular Arab Spring. But it's something that is coming to many other third world countries, because the things we've talked about, which is soaring commodity prices, and we're beginning to see that coming back with inflation, and food scarcity is something that is going to hit Africa. It is hitting African countries. It's going to hit big swathes of Asia as well. The lucky countries like China, India, Brazil, Turkey, South Africa, the ones that are being able to grow at 8-9% and develop a strong middle class, are separating themselves from the many countries that haven't been able to grow like that. And by being successful, they're bringing billions of people into middle-class living. And all those new middle-class people in China and India want to eat meat. They want to eat like everybody else does. Their calorie intake is doubling and sometimes tripling. So this is going to drive up commodity prices in a big way, because they can afford to eat well and to buy cars and to buy all these goods that only Westerners were able to afford 30, 40 years ago. So that's going to change things for the people at the bottom who are not making it. And I think your caller is right. America does have to focus on its own things. And we've headed straight into a terrible debt crisis because we've overspent, and we continue to not downsize our foreign policy and get sucked into one place after the next and spend billions, often not fixing problems overseas or pretending to fix them, but not really fixing them.
Mm. Well, let's take another caller here. Champaign County, line number two. Hello.
Well, I think we're undertaxed, actually, or the people that have the money are undertaxed, but that's another discussion, too. I'm out of radio range. I just drove out a little while ago, so I'll have to see the archive later. But the economic sort of connectededness to the rest of the world was exacerbating the already police state kind of post-colonial situation that Syria has been for so many years. The expert at torture, and of course the Bush administration took advantage of that in some ways by shipping people there. But I'm just wondering how much of if you can sort of sort out the forces that are in this. You say some of it's cultural, but certainly the economics are quite important. And there's a factor that I just don't know how to assess, which I'd like for you to comment on, is that there are, I think, the Iraqi refugees into Syria number in the hundreds of thousands. I'm not sure if that's true or not. We don't hear much about
it. It is true.
Displacement. And I guess for a while that might have been an advantage because they may have had some money to bring in, but now it's basically, you know, guest workers and the whole sort of exacerbation of the economic malaise. I'm wondering if that's also a factor, and I won't hang up, but I'll listen.
All right. Well, yeah, you talk about connections between what has happened in Iraq and what's happening in Syria.
Well, your caller is well informed, and there are almost a million Iraqi refugees still living in Syria today. Many of them are Christians. About 200,000 to 300,000 of those are Christians, because the Christians suffered more than many in Iraq because they were weaker, and as minorities, they were easily attacked and kidnapped, ransomed, demanded of their children, this sort of thing. Churches were bombed. So this is one of the reasons that Syrian minorities have become so fearful of change and are digging in their heels and supporting this regime. They don't want to be like Iraq. In some ways, the Ottoman Empire, a very multi-ethnic and multi-religious empire, when it crashed at the end of the First World War, was destroyed by Great Britain. And Europeans tried to, you know, draw lines on the map and build nation states, one of them being Syria. They did it, and, you know, there was no good way to do it. But there is a multi-ethnic society, and in some ways that has not congealed into a nation state. It has partly congealed. But this was what makes kicking over the governments or revolution so potentially fraught. It could lead to ethnic cleansing. It might not. But it could, and it makes people nervous. And that's, you know, that's at the heart of this. Iraq, the turmoil in Iraq, in some ways helps the regime because it's terrified Syrians. They don't want to be like Iraqis. They don't see the Iraqi experiment as successful, and they don't want to go through that instability. So the elite class of Sunnis in Syria have not abandoned the regime. I've just talked to a few business people in Syria in the last few days, and they all say, most of them say, you know, we don't want, because we don't know who the leadership of the opposition is, and we don't want to get into the Iraq situation. Now, others have more faith that their country will end up, on their feet, and they don't see a way out with this regime because they see that they believe the revolutionary forces are going to continue to agitate and that the economy will just go down and down. And then in some ways it's better just to get through this. And, you know, even if it takes a small civil war, that they will hold on to their money, hunker down, and hope for better things in the future. But this is the kind of anxiety. Both of those scenarios are bad scenarios. And it's the kind of anxiety that has set in Syria. And that's why many people have not come out on the streets to demonstrate, particularly in the big cities where people have a lot to lose. And that's why, you know, this young tourist going to Syria saw a picture of a country that was friendly and inviting and stable.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Joshua Landis. He's a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma. We're talking about Syria, and we'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, we examine the origins of the financial crisis with Gretchen Morgenson, co-author of the new book Reckless Endangerment, how outsized ambition, greed, and corruption led to economic Armageddon. Morgenson is a financial reporter and columnist for the New York Times. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
You'll also want to tune to our companion station WILL-TV Channel 12 for the next edition of the program Frontline. That's tonight at 8 o'clock. The title of the show is Wiki Secrets. It's the biggest intelligence breach in U.S. history, the leaking of more than 500,000 classified documents on the WikiLeaks website. Bradley E. Manning, an Army intelligence analyst, is charged with handing them over. But who is he? And what does his story tell us about how and why the secret cache of documents may have been leaked? That's Wiki Secrets on Frontline tonight at 8 on WILL-TV. This is Focus, a morning talk show. We're here weekday mornings, 10 noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. Tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, we'll talk with Francis Fukuyama from Stanford University about his new book, The Origins of Political Order, From Pre-Human Times to the French Revolution. Also tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, talk about how we battle the problem of non-native invasive species here in the state of Illinois. And we'll have two guests, Reuben Keller, from Notre Dame, and also Glenn Sandiford, who's a journalist and environmental researcher. That's tomorrow. You can find out what we'll be doing over the next few days on Focus by going to our website. That way you can also hear past programs you might have missed. It's at WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour, our guest is Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at University of Oklahoma, where he is associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies. He teaches modern Middle Eastern history and politics, writes about Syria and its surrounding countries, and we're talking about recent developments in Syria. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I wonder, Professor Landis, there are a lot of people who are interested in seeing positive change in Syria. But at the same time, there's this great worry, I think, internally within Syria and also in the region about what might happen if the Assad regime should fall. Is there anything that the United States, for example, or the West or anybody outside of Syria could do to try to encourage some progress, democratically speaking, and yet not have it be something so potentially cataclysmic as a regime change?
Well, that is the conundrum. And President Obama, in his big Middle East speech a few days ago, he came out with a statement that Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, has to either facilitate change or get out of the way, he said. And it was a tough statement. He's put sanctions on the president himself, and he says he reiterated a number of times that the Syrian regime has to stop shooting people. Now, of course, what does that mean? If they stop shooting people, the revolution may very well be successful, and lots of people would come out and would overthrow. The military could collapse. We don't know what would happen. We just don't know, because we don't have a good sense of who is leading the opposition. There isn't a consolidated leadership yet. The opposition is trying to organize a big conference in Turkey in the coming month. But we'll see whether they have success in identifying their plans. But we don't know what to do, and America doesn't know what to do. President Obama has made it clear that he wants to stand on the side of democracy and change in Syria. That's a big switch from his 2009 speech, where he said he was going to try to engage with both Ahmadinejad in Iran and Bashar al-Assad in Syria, moving away from the Bush doctrine, which had been democracy for the greater Middle East and change in the greater Middle East. So in some ways, oddly enough, President Obama has come around full circle and has articulated a foreign policy in the Middle East that is much closer to George Bush's. That opens up, as you indicate, this sort of slippery slope towards regime change and supporting regime change in Syria. President Obama hasn't quite gone there yet. I think people in Washington are increasingly beginning to accept that they're going to have to move towards a post-Assad Syria. Of course, nobody knows what it is. Everybody fears an Iraq-type meltdown where national institutions like the army and so forth would crumble, which could open the door towards extremism, the growth of militias, and potential civil war. And Syria is so centrally located. Its neighbors include Turkey, Iraq, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia is a hop, skip, and a jump away on the other side of Jordan. These countries don't want revolution in Syria. Some of them would like to see a regime change, but they don't want the violence that's attendant on it. So most of them have taken the devil we know attitude is better than the one we don't. That is increasingly creeping towards supporting regime change, but it hasn't really arrived there yet because of the potential for tons of refugees to come spinning out of Syria.
You know, you mentioned the speech that the president gave last week, which was billed as being a major speech on U.S. policy in North Africa and in the Middle East. And the president, shortly after he took office, one of the very first things that he talked about was wanting to his interest in improving relations between the United States and the Muslim world. And I think that a lot of people were disappointed that more didn't come of that, and they saw last week's speech as being yet another opportunity to try and make another start on that same project. And I think people also noted that opinion research in the Middle East shows that people continue to be very negative in their attitudes toward the United States. Do we trace that to the fact that, well, maybe the president has talked about wanting to improve relations, that in terms of policy, that things actually haven't changed very much?
They haven't changed very much. And President Obama, 2009, created an implicit linkage between ending the Arab-Israeli conflict and improving relations with Arab countries and the Islamic world. That his efforts at ending that Arab-Israeli conflict failed miserably, in part because the Palestinian leadership was in disarray, but in part because Prime Minister Netanyahu said, we're not going to give up this land, we're not going to create a Palestinian state. And it was very intransigent on the notion of negotiating and stopping settlements, for example, which was the first thing that President Obama asked of him. That we've seen the same controversy with his present speech. And this is one of the reasons why Arab neighbors are skeptical. The United States has reaffirmed and increased its military aid to Israel, promising over $30 billion in the next 10 years, and other benefits, a new missile system and so forth. To Egypt, it promised $2 billion, but it's really switching that money from the military aid that we used to give to Egypt over towards softer economic aid that's under the rubric of democracy now. But so it hasn't really changed much. And what people are focused on, of course, is the foot dragging in places like originally Egypt, but also Bahrain, and the coddling of the monarchies in the Gulf, particularly Saudi Arabia, but also the sort of the difficulties in Libya, where you know this bombing goes on, and they see people getting killed, but little progress, and Libya is being progressively destroyed now. That is not America's fault. But unfortunately, because it's American airplanes and European airplanes doing it, this messy situation in Libya becomes tied with this what happened in Iraq and what's going on in Afghanistan and the endless bombing and dead people being shown on Al Jazeera all the time. And so Middle Easterners tend to associate America with killing Middle Easterners and with coddling Israel and coddling dictators, and that hasn't really changed. And Obama tried, as you say, to switch that and say, look, we're on the side of the common person, we're on the side of democracy, freedom, liberty. But that judgment is still not made, has not been, Middle Easterners have not sided on, have not seen Obama as that liberator yet.
We have about 10 minutes left. Here's a caller in Effingham. We'll go there, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, David. Love the show. The comments by an announcer at midpoint of your show about financial Armageddon, how appropriate is that? What I wanted to say was, and I'll try to keep it short, that what is happening, what your guest is articulating, the history of the whole paradigm of capitalist expansion was articulated best by Karl Marx, and imperialization, imperialism, and the whole thing that keeps degenerating. And I want to go back to Lebanon just for a second. Ronald Reagan, when they blew up and killed nearly 400 Marines there, a little truck drove up and kaboom, and the next, within hours, that whole thing was abandoned. And it is now, I think, guided by Al Jazeera, or not Al Jazeera, but the primary Islamic...
Hezbollah.
Hezbollah, yeah.
Hezbollah, yes. That's, thank you. Well, I'll ring off, and thanks again.
Well, your caller brings up another, obviously... America has had a very mixed role in the Middle East. In the early part of the 20th century, America was seen very much as siding against France and Britain. The League of Nations and Woodrow Wilson's call for self-determination was embraced by Middle Easterners. One of the major Egyptian parties, the Wafd Party, grew up in trying to embrace Woodrow Wilson's call. Same thing in Syria and elsewhere. People thought, aha, we're going to be recognized as people, we're going to get our independence and so forth. Of course, America fell out of the League of Nations, Europe and France divided up the Middle East and ruled it as imperialists. And in many ways, the United States has stepped into their shoes. It inherited, after the Suez Crisis, it inherited authority in the Middle East. And as energy became increasingly important to the United States, the Middle East has been key to our national security policy. And part of that is because we beat Hitler in the Second World War because we denied him oil. His panzer units and tanks and airplanes stopped running. It wasn't because of our successful bombing campaign and other things. It was because we denied him oil in the Middle East. And that lesson stuck with the United States. Controlling oil supplies, and two-thirds of the oil supplies of the world are in the Middle East, is important for the United States. Maintaining a sort of military hegemony over that Gulf region, not letting the Chinese or the Russians or anybody else grab that, has been very key. And it has meant that we have made decisions that are often not in accordance with our ideology of democracy and freedom, but in accordance with our national, hard national interests and in trying to continue to preserve ocean strategic rights and military rights, military hegemony in the region.
That just, this perhaps is a little off, but one wonders if what's projected pans out and this resource either becomes less available or less important, that oil, and our continuing obsession with that region and putting so much of our resources into that region, what that means for American foreign policy in the future, if the day ever comes, and some people think it actually might not be all that far away, when oil really doesn't matter the way that it does now.
Well, I'm not sure it's that far away. America is developing some important new technologies to, this fracking and sideways drilling and so forth, that is opening up new abilities to prolong the life of fossil fuels. But they're going to remain important for a long time because they're so much cheaper than the alternatives, at least so far. And maybe this new technologies will kick in. But as we can see in America, giant houses with big furnaces that are clunking along on fuels, our cars, our planes, everything, it's going to take a long time to change that basic infrastructure.
Yeah. Well, back to Syria here. There are, we talked about the that the fact that, that within Syrian society, there are people who are really invested in the status quo and who continue to support the government and certainly would not want to see some sort of violent overthrow of the regime because they would worry about what would come next. And then there are people, particularly younger people, for whom the status quo has done nothing. And they're very concerned about their prospects for the future. They're very concerned about corruption and so forth. And that's where a lot of the agitation and generally for the poorer people in the country that are facing things like escalating food prices who are really having a hard time making it. And they're really interested in change. So as you read, though, about Syria, I have seen many references to a so-called silent majority. I'm not exactly sure what that means, right. But whether there are people there that are possibly a swing sort of faction, or at least they're not 100% behind either this new opposition or the government. And you wonder, those people, who are they, and what it is that they want.
Well, this silent majority is the big X factor, and that is the big middle classes and lower middle classes to a certain extent that inhabit the major cities and who haven't come out and demonstrated, in part because they've got a lot to lose and in part because they're distrustful of revolutionary change. Having watched Lebanon crumble into a civil war during the 70s and 80s that at the price of hundreds of thousands of dead and refugees spun out, same thing in Iraq. So they're very weary. They're very leery of change, and they believe that there's big hidden forces, America and others, that are manipulating this, Israel. So they tend to cling to the regime, and the regime plays on that. But if the economics get a lot worse, and it's very possible they will, because there is no tourism in Syria today, very little. Foreign investment is going to dry up, and Bashar al-Assad has painted, when he first came to power, a picture of Syrian progress and development that was very much connected to this globalization, making Syria an entrepot for pipelines, roads, trade, and bringing tourism to the country. That vision of a modernizing Syria that is connecting to the rest of the world is in complete ruins today, with sanctions from the whole world. No tourism, no foreign investment. The merchant class, the middle class that you just talked about, that is this silent majority, if the economic situation goes from bad to worse, the regime is going to run out of money. They're not going to be able to pay state salaries. They're not even going to be able to pay the military at some point. People will defect, and people will begin to say, boy, if this regime can't provide, maybe we better just hunker down and hope for the best with regime change. And that could be the scenario. It won't happen soon. The regime is very strong. The military is staying with the regime. They're going to beat back these demonstrations in the short term. But, you know, whether it's a year, 2, 3 years, things are going to change because there's been a deep culture of opposition and that has set in Syria, particularly amongst the younger generations, which used to be depoliticized. And today they're passionate, they're involved in politics, and they're not going to abandon this desire to have greater freedom and dignity and a better economic future for themselves.
So in the meantime, at least, it seems that the protests we've seen are not letting up and that the government is continuing to meet them with force. I think this past weekend was one of the, in terms of the numbers of people killed, was one of the worst since this whole began. So it seems like the government can't stop it. Even though it's responding with this dramatic force,
it's going to increase the levels of force.
So how do the protesters respond by simply in trying to increase their numbers and perhaps their willingness to put themselves in the line of fire?
That's been what's happened so far. There was a dip in the number of protesters in the few weeks before President Obama made his speech. We're not sure whether this latest sort of crudescence is in response to Obama's speech, and whether it'll die out again, or whether we're just seeing a very powerful movement that has developed a leadership, that has developed deep roots within society, and whether this is just going to sort of chug along at this very, without overtaking society, but continuing to disrupt the normal course of life, or whether it would just get bigger. And it's hard to say what's going to happen. As long as the Army and the security forces stay loyal, very difficult. People are going to get frightened. You know, if you're one in a giant school of fish going out there and there's only 20 people being shot and there's 100,000 people demonstrating on a given weekend or, you know, 50,000, you'll take your chances. But once the number of demonstrators declines and the number of people getting killed rises, it'll be much, you know, the calculations are going to begin to change dramatically.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure, again, as you say, you also have to consider what happens with the economy. I think the Egyptian case is interesting, that I think perhaps people have argued one of the reasons that the army finally turned against President Mubarak was that the army is very heavily invested in the Egyptian economy, and their opportunities for making money were suffering, so they finally decided, well, we're going to have to put a stop to this.
Right.
And although then at the same time, people who talk about this being a great victory for democracy, others would say, well, yeah, but it didn't really what we have there was a military coup. We don't know what's going to happen.
And, so, you know, there are cynics out there who say, well, this Arab Spring, you know, everybody's talking about, oh, the new democracy on the horizon, but it could lead to chaos and more instability in the future and not to democracy. We don't really know. This is where that troubling economic picture provides a different reading on things. You know, this could just be the beginning of some meltdowns because regimes have been unable to provide for their people. And how are these new regimes that creep up and don't have as much control going to make things better? Will tourists come back to Egypt? We're running out of the University of Oklahoma, a lot of exchange programs and other things. We've got a flagship Arabic program. We want to send lots of students to Egypt. We're not sending them. We've canceled all this stuff. We're going to Morocco now. That is just the tip of the iceberg. All sorts of people are going to be avoiding the Middle East. Tourism has crashed. How is this, you know, this democracy, this budding democracy in Egypt is in a race against time, because the longer they don't get their stuff together, the more the economic infrastructure begins to cave in and create pressures that cannot be contained.
Mm. And with the Syrian case, would you think that given enough time, if that trend continued, we saw the same thing happen in Syria, then it could come to a point where the army, the people who are involved in state security might say, well, we have to step in and do something about this?
It could be a coup. You know, the trouble is once you start fighting amongst yourselves, there's a strong sense of, you know, if we don't stick together, we're going to sink together. And, it depends. If the government can pay people and make it through, they can survive. But if they stop being able to pay people, then things fall apart. And you would get the rise of extremism and militias and challenges to the government authority. And Syria doesn't have lots of oil. It doesn't have tons of resources other than, you know, tourism, transit trade, and so forth that would dry up if there's insecurity. So it's not like Iraq, which has been able to fall back on its oil riches in some ways to try to, you know, with the promise of being able to dig itself out of this chaos.
There, we'll have to stop. We're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Joshua Landis, is a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter on Syrian politics. You can read it. It's on the web. Professor Landis, thank you very much for talking
to us. Well, David, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
We're on the web at WILL.illinois.edu. You can catch up on past Focus programs you may have missed. Check on the schedule for future shows. Hear all of our local production. It's all there anytime you're ready for it if you want to listen. So it's WILL.illinois.edu. That's it for us here on Focus. Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. UIL.edu. 1 minute before noon, 80 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. In Kansas City, July wheat is trading at 919 and three quarters. That's down 11 and a quarter. September, 939 and a quarter, down 10 and a half. July wheat in Chicago, 784 and three quarters, down 18 and a quarter. September, 833, down 17 and a half. July corn, 736 and three quarters, down 17 and a quarter. September, 707 and three quarters, down 12. December, 663 and a quarter, down 7 and a quarter. March, 674 and three quarters, down 8 and a quarter. July soybeans, 1377, down up 3 and a quarter. Excuse me, that's up 3 and a quarter. August, 1373 and a quarter, up 6. September, 1364 and a half, up 6 and a quarter. November, 1357 and three quarters, up 7. July meal, 359.90, up 110. July oil, 57.38, up 16. June live cattle, 102.57 and a half, up 42 and a half. August, 104.20, up 10. May feeder cattle, 123.95, up 15. August, 122.85, up 10.